The Wake Up Call with Richard Martin, Mondays and Fridays at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Radio Network. Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of GF Investment Services, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent the views of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments based off of Richard Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener and the investor.
Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Richard Martin here from Singapore on this fateful, historic day, Monday, the 1st of August, 2011, otherwise known as a civic holiday in Canada and the 1st of Ramadan. Well, why is it historic? Stock market was up over 100 points a few moments ago. It's now down 30. Exactly what happened after Osama bin Laden got knocked off. It slammed up and then slammed down and never saw those levels again. Well, look, ladies and gentlemen, I've told you that I'm not going to talk about this congressional agreement or disagreement until it's signed into law, and I will not do so. But I will just say this. If I had been living in the United States today, this past weekend would have put absolute paid to my continued existence in your great country. I would be in the process today of making arrangements to leave at some point within the next 3 months. Your government officers, ladies and gentlemen, do not have the slightest idea what they're doing. They are completely blind. They are searching for solutions where there are none. They're making the wrong decisions. They're fighting with each other about things which have no importance or relevance whatsoever. And the ultimate conclusion will be a disaster which will be felt around the world and which will be remembered for generations to come. I don't know how else to put this. The country is in an absolute shambles. It is completely out of whack. I feel total and utter pity for America and Americans today. I have no other way of expressing this. Sadness and pity and shame. And I had no idea how America got into this state. I had no explanation for it. A wonderful country with wonderful prospects, with everything going for it, is now in the gutter. And there is no light at the end of any kind of tunnel in that gutter either. Well, there is no way to spin the GDP report that came out on Friday morning as anything but grim. It was just like last May when the consensus was that the second quarter GDP would be 3.3%, and that had been revised down to 2.7%, but the number came in at 1.3, which was actually much lower than the expected 1.9. And do you realize that normally at this time in a recovery, growth is close to three times that number, or 3.6%? And what's even worse is that the first quarter number was revised down from 1.9% to an anemic 0.36%. There are three monthly revisions that follow, and after a few years, it is revised yet again with the aid of hindsight. And the fourth quarter of 2010 was taken down from 3.1% to 2.35%. And it gets worse. It seems that BEA, went back and revised the numbers for the recession. Would it surprise you to learn that the recession was worse than we thought at the time? The peak-to-trough decline was 5.1% instead of 4.1%. That means that in real terms, the economy has not yet recovered back to the pre-recession levels. David Rosenberg, who I quote frequently here, notes that in his research that goes back to 1947, and never before have we seen this dynamic of the level of overall economic activity lower on the second birthday of the recovery than it was at the prior cycle peak. Typically, 2 years into a recovery, real GDP is already 9.5% above the pre-recession high. Economists had been talking about an improving economy this whole time, while people were losing their jobs and homes and wondering what the economists were talking about. Well, now, with all these downward revisions, we can see that the people were right and the economists were wrong. I keep saying this, ladies and gentlemen, because you have to get it. Economists have no idea what's going on. I mean, this is really amazing. The economists in Washington produced figures for the first quarter that were wildly more optimistic than they turned out to be, and they've been overly optimistic for years. It's quite possible that the most recent figure of 1.3% is also wildly optimistic. Macroeconomics models are completely static in time, and economists assume that the same macroeconomics model that worked in the 70s and 80s also works today, an assumption which is completely absurd on its face. As I've pointed out so many times, economists have been consistently wrong about everything, at least since 1995. They didn't predict and can't explain the 1990s tech bubble, the real estate and credit bubbles, the financial crisis since 2007, where we are today, what's coming next year. Their predictions are no better than flipping a coin. In fact, since they've been predicting each month for several years that real estate prices had reached a bottom and that a V-shaped recovery would begin the next quarter, their predictions are much worse than flipping a coin. Europe is now in austerity mode. U.S. cities and states are cutting back. The odds of more fiscal stimulus in the U.S. are roughly zero. The U.S. might and should lose its AAA rating. Australia is a basket case on the bursting of its property bubble. Canada has the second or third largest property bubble next to China and Australia. The bond market is targeting Italy and Spain. Brazilian defaults are soaring. China is overheating and needs to slow. Yet the average economist is looking for a robust second half. Go figure. Nothing the government tells you can be trusted. They will say anything and do anything to avoid panic. But despite their best efforts, they cannot stop the inevitable. Ladies and gentlemen, rest assured, panic is coming. Is it any wonder that many Americans believe that the economic downturn is still in progress? Home prices have fallen to 2002 levels. Values have dropped nearly 50% in parts of Florida, California, Nevada, and Arizona. Property values are also down that much in parts of troubled big cities like Detroit. Estimates are that as many as 11 million homes have underwater mortgages. Banks have inventories of as many as 2 million foreclosed homes, which have not even been released to the market. Home prices could fall another 10% if current trends persist. Perhaps the most powerful argument that the recession never ended or that a new one has begun is the persistence of unemployment. 14 million people are out of work. A third of those have been jobless for more than a year. Employment data showed the jobless rate rose unexpectedly and that the economy added only 58,000 jobs. Experts believe that the unemployment rate will not improve significantly until the monthly gain in jobs is consistently 300,000 jobs or more. And at that rate, the gains would have to go one for more than 2 years to bring the economy back to what is traditionally considered a reasonable unemployment figure. Unemployment creates two immediate problems. People without jobs drastically curtail their spending, which will ultimately affect GDP growth. The second is the need for tens of billions of dollars every year in government aid to keep the unemployed from becoming destitute. That support has increased deficits, and the domino effect is that cash-strapped governments need to make more spending cuts. It may be the biggest challenge the economy faces. Unemployment has worsened because people over 65 continue to work, because the values of their homes, which they once counted on as the financial basis of their retirements, have dropped so sharply. Older Americans also fear that cuts in Medicare and perhaps Social Security are inevitable, which increases the cost of their golden years. The jobs that older Americans have taken are often ones that younger Americans might have. People in their 20s must accept low wages to enter the workforce. This has delayed their prime consuming years well into their 30s, which will damage GDP recovery now and for another decade. The worst of the unemployment problem is the roughly 5 million Americans who have been unemployed for over a year. Their unemployment benefits have run out in many cases. The burden of their care falls to their families, friends, community organizations, and non-profits. A family which has to support an unemployed person may be a family which cannot spend beyond its basic needs. To the extent that the federal or state governments can support the unemployed, the cost to run support programs increases. Housing is considered by many economists to be the single largest drag on the American economy, and the housing market has gotten much worse in the last 2 months. A report from the New York Federal Reserve published earlier this year said that, quote, when home prices began to fall in 2007, owners' equity in household real estate began to fall rapidly from almost $13.5 trillion in the first quarter 2006 to a little under $5.3 trillion in the first quarter 2009, a decline in total home equity of over 60%, end of quote. Real estate research firm Zillow reported on more recent developments, quote, negative equity in the first quarter reached new highs with 28.4% of all single-family homes with mortgages underwater, from 27% in the fourth quarter, end of quote. Many homeowners who want to sell their homes cannot do so because they cannot afford to pay their banks at closing. Whether for good or ill, the American home was the primary source for money used for retirements, college educations, and the purchases of many expensive items, such as cars. Economists point out that the leverage helped contribute to the credit crisis as people couldn't cover the cost of their home equity loans as real estate values collapsed. This may be true, but the drop in value happened so quickly that the balance sheets of millions of Americans were destroyed. Their ability to consume was severely damaged, further harming GDP. High mortgage payments bankrupted or nearly bankrupted people who have lost jobs or have found that their incomes had stagnated. The building industry became a shambles overnight, and whatever the effects have been over the last 3 years, they're getting progressively worse as home values drop to decade lows. There is no relief in sight because potential buyers worry that price erosion has not ended. The United States debt ceiling, currently at $14.294 trillion, has been raised, probably almost certainly, before the government has to cut back essential services. It might seem that the economic and employment effects of the debt cap are the same as the deficit, but they are actually more insidious and longer term. The first byproduct of debt reduction, or at least a slowdown in its growth, is a combination of higher taxes and a lower level of government services. Higher taxes usually slow economic improvements, particularly when they are not coupled with stimulus measures. A number of economists have pointed out the expense reduction alone will not sharply improve the United States balance sheet. The increase in Medicare and Social Security costs brought on by an aging population are also likely to trigger a need for higher taxes. Tax increases could keep the economic growth of the U.S. on hold for years. That's what you're going to see at the end of 2012 when the Bush tax cuts run out. The taxation of companies decreases and often eliminates profits, particularly during an already troubled economic period. Profits which disappear usually cause cuts in purchasing and jobs. Taxes on wages and inheritance undermine consumer spending. And a growth in national debt from already all-time highs will increase the borrowing costs of the U.S., which of course in turn drives up interest rates for everything from mortgages to credit cards. The lack of access to credit has hurt the economic activity of both individuals and small businesses. Many very large companies can borrow money at rates as low as 2% because their strong cash flows and balance sheets allow them to do so. Banks have been much less willing to loan money to companies with under 100 workers because these firms often rely on a few customers for revenue and usually have very little money on hand. Early in June, the House Small Business Committee held hearings. Among its findings were that concerns about risk and a slow economy has made financial institutions reluctant to lend to small businesses, the main driver of economic growth. Committee Chairman Sam Graves said Congress will need to bridge the gap between the two sides. There is no plan to accomplish that. Individual borrowers find themselves in a similar position. The cost of credit cards and debt is still above 20% in many cases, although the Federal Reserve loans money to large firms for interest rates close to zero. Potential home buyers, who might help to break the gridlock of slow house sales, often find that banks want down payments as high as 20%. The median down payment in 9 major U.S. cities rose to 22% last year on properties purchased through conventional mortgages, according to an analysis done for the Wall Street Journal by real estate portal Zillow.com. That percentage doubled in 3 years and represents the highest median down payment since the data were first tracked in 1997. Homes which are not sold often put such great burdens on owners that they are barely consumers of the goods and services that drive GDP. Home builders have continued to struggle. Construction jobs, which were a huge amount of the employment base in states like Florida, have not returned. Well, let me give you my information quickly and then we'll move on here. If you'd like to call into the show, which of course we always want you to do, and it always makes it much more lively when you do so, the number is 888-874-4888. Once again, our toll-free number, 888-874-4888. If you would like to email me, you can do that. And by doing so, you will need to write to the following address. rm@gfawd.com. That's RM for Richard Martin at GFAWD for Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design .com. Once again, my email address, email is open permanently here, and I'm looking at it right now, and have something, a little email just came in, actually. The email address once more, rm@gfawd.com. and my personal direct line, which you may call if you would like to ask me questions on a personal level about your own financial problems. I'm sure most of you have some, sadly. Do feel free to call me. I will help out as much as I possibly can. The number is a Sarasota number, area code 941-441-1682. Again, that's 941, area code 441-1682. That is my personal direct line. Goes to Florida, comes to Singapore, and leave a message, your name and phone number. If I'm not here, I will call you back. Well, a slowdown in the Chinese economy is usually seen as a cause of global commodity price inflation, but you know, the effects cut two ways. China's appetite for energy and raw materials may fall, but the demand for goods and services by its very large and growing middle class drops as well. Chinese purchaser manufacturing and export numbers have fallen as the central government has tightened the ability to borrow money. I just got an email from Kevin Moran about that, and thought I would throw this in, Kevin, for your benefit. U.S. exports to China are key to the health of many American businesses. John Frisbee, the president of the U.S.-China Business Council, recently said, and I quote, "Over the last decade, we have seen exports to China rise from $16.2 billion to $91.9 billion, a 468% increase," end of quote. Well, as that rate slows, it, of course, has a profound effect on tens of thousands of American companies and their employees. U.S. firms with large operations in China are also affected. GM is one of the two largest car firms in China, along with Volkswagen. Large U.S. corporations like Walmart and Yum! Brands rely significantly on China to boost global sales. Without vibrant consumer spending in China, American companies will suffer. The federal budget deficit has killed any chance for another economic stimulus package, which many prominent economists like the Nobel Prize winner Paul Krugman mistakenly and misguidedly say is essential to create a full recovery. As I have emphasized so many times here, the first $787 billion Obama stimulus package did not work. If a drop in unemployment and a sharp improvement in GDP were its primary goals, the deficit has caused a call for severe austerity measures, which have already become part of the economic policies of countries from Greece to the UK to Japan. Job cuts in the US will not be restricted to the federal level. A recent UBS investment research analysis predicted that state and local governments will cut 450,000 jobs this year and next. That process is already well underway. States like California and New York currently run massive deficits, and the rates they must pay on bonds has risen accordingly. Newspaper headlines almost daily report on battles between state unions and governors over employment and benefits. Oil prices are supposed to drop as the economy slows, as they did in 2008 and early 2009, when crude fell from over $140 to under $50. That drop at least allowed consumers and businesses like airlines to more easily afford fuel. Recently, crude has moved back to around $100. American budgets have been hurt by the rising cost of gas. Americans of more modest means have been particularly affected. A slowdown in driving usually also leads to a decline in the retail sector as consumers reduce unnecessary travel to stores. The impact on businesses is just as great. Airlines suffer, and so do firms which rely on petrochemicals. OPEC, for now, has signaled it will not increase production. The recent profitability of the automobile industry is entirely due to the layoffs it has made over the last 5 years, as opposed to generating new sales. GM and Chrysler had emerged from bankruptcy. Year-over-year monthly sales did improve late last year and through April, but May sales stalled. GM's revenue dropped by 1% compared to May of 2010. Ford's sales were down about as much. There are, of course, many reasons for this, including high gas prices and the constrained manufacturing capacity of the Japanese automakers because of the earthquake. Consumers also may be deferring purchases, or the big purchases, because they are worried about their economic prospects. Slow car sales are not just a sign of lagging consumer confidence. They may also be a harbinger of tougher times ahead. These companies shed several hundred thousand jobs before and during the last recession. Car firms have only just begun to hire again, but that trend will die with a plateau in sales. Well, if the U.S. does default, the repo market will probably cease to work. It's hard to imagine money market funds operating under this scenario. The interbank market would just freeze up. The fallout would be far worse than after Lehman's default. It would drive a string of U.S. states and municipalities into bankruptcy if it lasted more than a few weeks, while the multiplier effect would tip the economy into a self-defeating downward spiral. It would severely dent the credibility of the U.S. as a global financial player. It would probably push up yields on U.S. treasuries and eurozone borrowing would rise in lockstep, playing havoc with debt dynamics. Such a rise in the risk-free rate would reverberate across the world and across asset classes. It could push both peripheral and core European bonds into default territory. It would almost certainly lead to a renewed global recession and banking crisis, only this time there would be only one country left to absorb the losses, China. All right, well, almost time for our break, but let's take a couple of emails before we do that. One which just came in from, I think, Joni, who says, "Yes, Richard, it's a shame we are all not out in the streets right now. This is a complete outrage. The problem is we're all too busy just making a living, staying afloat, and also squeaking in some time to have fun. And personally, I stay away from crowds. Too scary. How can I stop paying Social Security? I'd do better investing it myself." Well, good luck to you, Joni. You can't. You're locked in. Whether you get anything back at the end of the day, of course, is something else, but you're not going to get it by opting out, I'm afraid. I'll be having a piece in next week's weekend reading all about the fascinating reasons why it is that nobody complains, nobody makes any fuss. Got news for you, ladies and gentlemen. You've all been dumbed down. Well, I'll have some details for you next weekend, something to look forward to, those of you who are signed up to my email service. There's not going to be any stones left unturned here, ladies and gentlemen. You will get the information from the wake-up call. Trust me. Even if you don't get it anywhere else, you will get it here. All right, Steve came in with an email who said, "Richard, I just participated in a discussion group where one of the topics was happiness." I'm assuming that Steve's writing from my little ditty on happiness from last Friday. "Some good ideas came up. I think Epicurus, around 400 BC, was onto something. For Epicurus, the purpose of philosophy was to attain the happy, tranquil life, characterized by ataraxia, peace and freedom from fear, and aponia, the absence of pain, and by living a self-sufficient life surrounded by friends. Apparently, it's also been proven that volunteering and writing down your blessings regularly helps one be happy. I believe volunteering reminds us there are people more worse off than ourselves, while at the same time reminds us of what we do have going for us. The feeling of making a difference, even if it's an illusion, is very powerful. However, volunteering to wash a billionaire's car will likely not cheer anyone up. As I understand it, Bhutan, a country between China and India, has devised its own GNP rating, gross national happiness. Their per capita income is around $1,400, according to Wikipedia. I have to say, even their national animal looks tranquil. I think it goes without saying that without health and a meaningful direction in life, it would be difficult to be happy. I wanted to ask if you laughed when Bernanke agreed with you that gold was an asset and not money when Ron Paul pressed him a few weeks ago. Must be the only time you ever agreed with Ben. Gotta take any joke I can in this economy. Thanks for keeping us informed, Steve. Well, yes, indeed. Gold, money, I don't think so. You know, apparently there was an incident a couple of weeks ago when a group of guys went to a fairly expensive restaurant, and at the end of the meal, the waiter brought the bill, and just for grins, somebody put down several thousand dollars worth of gold coins on top of the bill. And when the waiter came, he just looked at it and said, "Will that be cash or credit, sir?" So there you go. If gold is money, apparently waiters in expensive restaurants don't know it. Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, we have come to the moment of truth. That is the halfway point. And so I shall take a gulp of water, and you shall take a break, and I shall be right back.
Progressive Radio Network, information for the independent mind.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we're back. I wonder how many of you realize just how extreme the top wealth of the United States is. You know, we hear lurid statistics about the very wealthy, but I'm not sure that that drives home just how much wealth there really is at the top in the U.S. Let me see if I can put this in some sort of simple perspective. The top 1% of U.S. households receive nearly as much income each year as the value of Germany's GDP. And they receive more income than all other nations' GDP, individually, not cumulatively, except for the GDPs of Japan, China, and the US. Let me just repeat that. The top 1% of U.S. households receive nearly as much income each year as the value of Germany's GDP. And they receive more income than all other nations' GDP, again, individually but not cumulatively, except for the GDPs of Japan, China, and the U.S. The financial wealth of the top 1% exceeds the value of the entire GDP of the European Union, the world's largest GDP in aggregate. Moreover, the top 1% could lose 90% of their financial wealth and still collectively have more wealth than all but each of the world's top 8 GDPs. That's US, China, Japan, Germany, France, UK, Brazil, and Italy. When one hears that wealth and income inequality is extreme in the US, I suspect that many just don't realize how extreme it really is. Peak oil, so-called, the falling net energy and available net exports, government austerity, and the effects of population overshoot simply imply that wealth and income concentration will become even more extreme, affecting what remains of the professional middle class, who are largely dependent upon the ongoing growth of debt money and government borrowing and spending. And right now, we're being told that the income of these people is off limits to any kind of tax hikes. Words fail me. I'm sorry, ladies and gentlemen.
I don't know what to say. Might as well go on to some other emails here. Andrew Boyle says, Richard, I hope you're well. Am I right to assume from your relative silence on the debt ceiling debate that you believe the crisis to be political posturing that will not change the underlying reality either way? I was thinking on Friday of the irony. If U.S. politicians managed to start the downward spiral by continuing this Mexican standoff, presumably you think a compromise will be reached that will encourage the markets to believe everything is settled and then the fundamentals will reassert themselves. We've been watching this process in the EU, the European Union, for the last 12 months or so. Kind regards, Andrew Boyle. Well, yes, Andrew, I suppose I should have really left that comment of yours until next week, because I really don't want to discuss this until we have, you know, final agreement and signatures on all these and votes on these things. But when you really bring the whole thing down to brass tacks here, the reality is that it's the blind leading the blind. You know, it's not even political posturing. It's just total confusion, intellectual confusion. And of course it won't change the, nothing that it is going to be said or done will change the underlying reality. But be that as it may, it's a pathetic statement of what the United States has become, and very embarrassing, I should have thought, for most Americans. Well, Betty Mason wrote in saying, Hi Richard, will you address the Treasury's becoming a toxic asset on your program tomorrow, i.e. today, due to the new deal being finalized in Washington? Are you still recommending buying Treasuries? Thank you, Betty Mason. Betty, I don't know that Treasuries are a toxic asset. No, I wouldn't call them a toxic asset. I would just say that you want to stick to lower maturities, as I've always said, shorter maturities. You will not get hurt by the by any type of default, because as Tim Geithner confirmed actually late last week, he said top priority will be given to U.S. Treasuries in terms of refunding. So I don't think that's kind of nicely confirms what I've always said to you on the show here, ladies and gentlemen, which is that you are really as secure as you can be in short-term Treasury bills. They are truly the last of the debts of the American government to default. So, as I said to you, if you have spare cash, do make sure that it's in a Treasury bill, money market fund, or Treasury bills, and that's what I would say too. But, Betty, don't go out buying like 10 or 30-year Treasuries, because you could get badly hurt with a decline in the value of these things. So the answer to whether I'm recommending buying Treasuries, yes, I am, but only short-term ones. Okay? All right, well, I have a request from Lewis, who says, Richard, I'm also on the brink of moving out. Good man, Lewis. And I'm wondering if any of your listeners in the central New Jersey area would like to get together and talk among other like-minded individuals. I'm proposing a Richard Martin meetup group. Oh, how nice. Thank you very much, Lewis. Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, if anybody in central New Jersey would like to touch base with a listener, a very nice listener who is well known to me, by the way, his name is Lewis, please send me an email and let me know, and I will put you in touch. Again, my email address is rm@gfawd.com. That's Richard Martin, RM, at GFAWD for Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design .com. Okay, once more, rm@gfawd.com. Okay, so that's anybody in central New Jersey who would like to get together with other like-minded individuals. All right, so Let me see. Well, frankly, if you're only able or willing to put down 3%, you're simply not serious about home ownership. I mean, it's laughable. 3% would have got you laughed out of any bank in America prior to 1994. Yet by 2007, 40% of all mortgages had less than 3% down payments. Think about that. 3%. 40% of all mortgages. You know, it's frightening to wonder what that number would be for less than 4% down or 5% down, still totally laughable and unserious levels of equity. I've said it for a while, mortgage lending to creditworthy home buyers has been a stable, profitable, and boring business in the United States of America for about 100 years. So for those who blame Wall Street greed for the crisis, I ask you, why now? Why did greed not appear, not infect the system, not attempt to seize filthy lucre for that 100 years? Why did greed only show up at that particular moment in time? And I further ask, why did greed not make its way to Canada, where they didn't have a housing and or banking crisis? Is greed only a U.S. and highly time-specific phenomenon? The answer is that government embarked at the urging of social justice activists on a policy campaign to degrade the prudential standards that prevailed in the housing lending market. The government effectively demanded and enforced irresponsible lending, and they got it. Unfortunately, the government can't repeal the iron laws of economics, so what they got was a flimsy, risk-infected financial system that was bound to crash, which it did. And guess who was responsible? Who could have stopped the whole thing in its tracks? I think you guessed correct. Alan Greenspan. Remember that the mortgage market was the purview of the Federal Reserve, and still is. And at any point in time, Alan Greenspan could have made a legal requirement that minimum mortgage requirements were 25% down, 30%, 40%, 50% down, 60%, 70% down. He had it within his power to do this, ladies and gentlemen, and he didn't do so because he wanted to be popular. He wanted to be loved. He was the maestro, a sickening individual. So we're not hearing too much from him these days, thank God. I don't know what happened to him, but he's definitely sort of disappeared off the radar for the time being, such as I see. I don't know whether that's really true or not, but I'm guessing that that is probably the case. Well, I've got a few people streaming in with requests to be linked up with Lewis, which is very encouraging, and all of you, you will indeed be linked with said gentleman. Well, ladies and gentlemen, you've probably heard that the government is considering closing 3,700 post offices nationwide. I thought a little background might be in order. Prior to Richard Nixon taking the U.S. dollar off the gold standard in 1971, stamps cost 6 cents. In the 40 years since then, the price of a first-class letter has been raised 20 times, nearly eightfold higher than before. To put things in perspective, the price of a stamp in 1863 was 3 cents. So we're talking about a 100% increase in 108 years, followed by a 733% increase over the next 40 years. And yet, despite such rampant price inflation, the U.S. Postal Service is hemorrhaging cash and nearing failure. In fiscal year 2010, the Postal Service suffered an $8.5 billion net loss, the latest in a serial trend of widening losses.
The only way the Postal Service keeps surviving is from the generosity of U.S. taxpayers and Chinese bondholders who foot the bill for its continuance. The Postal Service has nearly 600,000 employees. It's larger than the active component of the United States Army. In fact, and similar to how the army is far-flung all over the world in places where it has no business operating, the Postal Service has offices across small-town America where there is no chance of profit. There are over 3,000 post offices across the country that generate less than $27,500 in annual revenue. It's barely possible to pay rent and keep the lights on with that kind of revenue, let alone hire a staff, maintain delivery vehicles, or pay for fuel. An organization with such a costly structure is doomed to fail. And if it weren't a government agency, it would have gone bust a long time ago. By the government's own admission, the U.S. Postal Service can't compete with private courier services. Yet politicians insist on keeping it alive in the only way they know how, theft and deceit. Well, it's no secret that we're in one of the worst droughts of a lifetime. Could these weather conditions be the beginning of something much worse? Or even create a perfect storm that will lead to the beginning of the end of America's vitality? Central Texas land that had been plush with hay, corn, and vegetables is now completely barren. It's been so dry for the last 6 months in Texas that we've broken just about every record since the 1890s. One of the ranchers in the area says that he's being forced to sell all 1,500 head of cattle on his property due to lack of water and hay. There is simply no way for him to keep the herd alive unless conditions improve immediately. Farmers and ranchers are facing the real possibility that they will not be able to pay for the loans they extended in the previous growing session, or even the mortgages on their homes, because their revenue has, quite literally, dried up. Farmers in Oklahoma and in Texas are already bracing themselves for what may be their largest Armageddon-style event ever experienced. These two states are the largest producers of hay and cattle in the United States. However, due to persistent drought conditions plaguing that part of the country, the outcome has the two states seeing the smallest hay crop in over a century, thus creating a shortage of feed for livestock. Larry Redman, the state forage specialist at Texas A&M University, said, and I quote, "Farms may harvest only one crop from alfalfa and Bermuda grass this year, compared with three normally." The hay shortage is leading many cattle ranchers to sell off their herds prematurely to make any type of profit. Cattle that usually graze on fields through September or October are instead being sold to feedlots, where they are confined in pens and eat mostly corn. Stephen Kay, publisher for Cattle Buyers Weekly, admits that beef producers are culling cows and young females, which means smaller supplies of cattle for the next 2 years or longer. Don Close, the market director with the Texas Cattle Feeders Association in Amarillo, Texas, agrees with these sentiments and adds that liquidating the cattle herds is, quote, "going to make a tight supply even tighter as we get down the road," end of quote. Long-term drought conditions and hay shortages are not the only drastic events farmers need worry about. Fred Duval, a cattle rancher for over 50 years, suspects that if the drought continues for another 3 months, it will finish off some cattle raisers. Quote, "they'll have to completely sell out." The implications of these issues will be felt by the entire country through shortages of meat and surging prices for years to come. In fact, the USDA forecasts
that retail meat prices may increase this year as much as 7%, and dairy products may jump 6%, more than the rate of overall food inflation at 3 to 4%. As much as one would like to hope and pray for the weather conditions to change, this could be the beginning of a long-term disaster that the entire country will feel. This devastation is very similar to the drought conditions experienced during the 1930s that brought about the devastating dust bowls, which only intensified the suffering throughout the Great Depression. Increasing food prices, food shortages, droughts, families losing their homes. This is a familiar story. We all know that history can repeat itself. Whether or not we choose to see history repeating itself is the real question. However we decide to view this scenario, it's a modern-day disaster that will be hard to come back from. Preparing for harder days to come is inevitable at this point, especially in the farming and cattle business. Well, Sarita wrote in a nice email saying, "Hi, Richard. Just a note to tell you that one of the largest stores here in Manhattan, located at the heart of Lincoln Center on Broadway and 66th Street, where many would meet to browse and have coffee and enjoy the live events, has closed, and we're all very sad. Instead, we will have a Century 21 store. There is one bookstore in the Upper West Side which still offers that feeling of a community sharing in the delight of books and events, where one can hear authors read their works. How frightening to see these places disappear. Likewise, I heard that many schools are now not going to teach children to write with a pencil, since they will be using computers. I wonder where all the parents are and why there isn't an uproar over such insane decisions. Oh, and by the way, children won't be taught to use scissors either. No more cutting up pieces of paper for projects. I have been upset that the arts had been removed from our schools, but hearing that cursive writing, telling time on a regular clock, and allowing children to use scissors may be a thing of the past just boggles my mind. Regards, Sarita." Well, thank you, Sarita, for that. Finish about an anecdote about a man who used a loophole in the law to pay $16 for a $330,000 house. Kenneth Robinson beat the system. We should all be Kenneth Robinsons. Kenneth Robinson, the president, I say. Kenneth. Why all the fuss? Because Robinson found a loophole in the law that let him pay $16 to own a $330,000 house. It's a little-known law called adverse possession, where you can avoid the inconvenience and expense of applying for a traditional mortgage. He supposedly spent months and months researching the law and combing through listings to find the perfect house that would fit within the requirements of the law. The $330,000 house in Flower Mound, Texas, did just that. The perfect storm of events that happened to make the house available was that the house foreclosed, the original owner abandoned his mortgage, and the mortgage company closed shop. All Robinson had to do was file paperwork at the courthouse saying he claimed ownership of the property. And that cost all of $16. Under the law that Robinson exposed, if someone were to move into the abandoned home, they would have exclusive negotiating rights with the original owner. If the original owner wanted the squatter to leave, the owner would have to pay off his mortgage and the bank would have to file a lawsuit against the squatter to get him evicted. If that doesn't happen under Texas occupancy laws, Robinson believes the house will be his as long as he stays there for 3 years. The neighbors who live in the neighborhood are jealous and pissed. Some want him to pay up, just like they did. But if I learned one thing in life so far, but yet you can't knock the hustle. A. Good job, Kenneth. Well, ladies and gentlemen, you know, we have come to the end of another show. The market is sharply down. We've seen a huge intraday reversal in the market today. All those people who were going rah-rah over the so-called agreement must be wondering what happened to their investments. Anyway, well, I hope you've enjoyed the show today. I've given it my all. I really do feel sorry for those of you who have to tolerate this horrendous state of affairs. But I hope to have a comment for you on Friday about all this, assuming that it's all resolved. I just simply refuse to enter into all the shenanigans while they're taking place. Let them sort it all out, and then we'll come in wading in with some kind of a comment, which I will have. So anyway, ladies and gentlemen, with that, I wish you a wonderful week ahead, and this is Richard Martin wishing you well, and until Friday, bye-bye.